The Old Testament, the book of Nehemiah, chapter 2. In a sense, there are 4 months between chapters 1 and 2, but the word today in chapter 1, verse 11, indicates that the prayer of chapter 1 bridges the lapse of time, somehow or another. The month of Kislev in chapter 1 is December, and Nisan in chapter 2 is April. That's 4 months Nehemiah waited, prayed, and fasted. We often read scripture, you know, as if everything just happened at once. Like the Lord himself, of whom it is said, he spake, and it was done. But it's not always like that with us. And we need to understand that to fortify us against ungodly impatience, we learn to wait. We can't order the Lord about. We are his servants, not he ours. But that was a long season of prayer and fasting, wasn't it? 4 months. And don't you think that during those long, weary days and nights, Nehemiah might have thought that God had fallen asleep, or worse, had forgotten? Never. Never. His seeming delays are often for our refining. But the last thing in the world could be that he has forgotten or is too busy. The engines of his heart and mind never stop. Never. What was it used to be placarded in some homes? He is silently planning in love for you. He is silently planning. Emphasis on the silently planning in love for you. We must learn to trust God in his silences. And indeed, ultimately, revel in them. For great things are massing while God seems away or asleep. But Nehemiah, of course, was not always on his knees, except the knees of his heart. For he had a job to do, a very important one. He was cupbearer. Or as in the Joseph story in Genesis 42 and 2, you remember, he was butler to the king, especially to protect the king from his foes, or worse maybe, from his friends. I sometimes mistype the word friends without the R, and I'm shocked at what I see. Those who might poison the king's wine. And it was while Nehemiah was doing his duty by the king that the king noticed Nehemiah's face. A servant. He noticed a servant's face. Think of that. That in itself is remarkable in those ancient days when he might as easily, the king might as easily have ordered his head to be chopped off if he spilt a drop of the stuff. After all, what was the Egyptian butler's fault in Joseph's day? It doesn't say, simply that great Pharaoh was angry with his cupbearer and chief baker, for they had offended their lord and master, the king. It was a mercy indeed they were left alive. But here, you see, here, in his day, the monarch of all he surveyed, with absolute power of life and death over practically every living soul on earth at the time. And he notices the sad countenance of one of his servants, which is astonishing. Artaxerxes is called the long-handed, doubtless because he had long hands, but he must have also had a warm heart, at least towards some of his people. And surely this indicates one thing which follows another, namely that the king cared for Nehemiah, because that man trusted and respected him. Nor is this the only occasion of such mutual trust, such trust of Jews by pagan emperors, when we think of Mordecai, uncle of Esther, and of Daniel, to say nothing of Zerubbabel and Ezra. This is beautiful, beautiful. The profound respect of these pagan emperors for Jews. It cannot be exaggerated. The Lord's children and servants have a heavy responsibility to be respected in the world for the quality of their duteous employment. Do the people you work with know what you are? And the form of words the king used shows that he had an understanding of degrees of sadness. He knew that Nehemiah wasn't ill. He had drunk no poisoned wine from the royal chalice, and yet Nehemiah looked sad, and his sadness was visible. But of course, you don't fast and pray for 4 months without it showing. Now, I don't believe Nehemiah deliberately put on a sad face. Do you? That would be far, it seems to me, far from the character of this man. It must have been that there was some kind of rapport between these two men, which was almost instant. And yet, Nehemiah had such a fear of the king that he would never have presumed. And it took these months of prayer and waiting for the effects involuntarily to begin to show in his face. Indeed, is there not a hint that Nehemiah had tried desperately to hide his sorrow when he says, "I had not been sad in the king's presence before." It was apparently in spite of himself that Nehemiah betrayed his preoccupation with his sorrow. And if this is so, Then Nehemiah was far from using his sad face to draw the king's attention to his sorrow. But as he prayed and fasted these months, he looked to the Lord alone for his answer. And 4 months in that state is a long time to wait, until in sheer hidden exasperation his sorrow suddenly shows. I think it must have been a complete surprise and an astonishment to Nehemiah that the king remarked on his sad countenance. And I could imagine that Nehemiah instantly thought, O Lord God, you surprising deity, so this is the way you are to answer my prayer. But of course, something more than surprise seized the man as he handed the king his wine after having dutifully tasted it. For recognizing the Lord's okay, Nehemiah knew. Surely he knew instantly when the king took notice of his sad face that this was the hour in which he was to speak to the king. And you can imagine the almost cold terror that would have seized him for a moment when he realized that now he had to speak. He was taking his life in his hands, but realizing not so much that this was his chance, perhaps his last chance to speak, but realizing that God had provided the opening, he could only take a deep breath, a breath of fervent prayer, and find his voice. And you know, there's a great lesson here on how to tackle worldly people. Not to say, indeed, how to evangelize them. No confrontational tactics. It is done through long prayer and waiting for God's opportunity. Oh, may I tell you about that with trepidation and with some delicacy. My classic example of waiting God's hour is that of getting on for half a century now ago. I was deeply concerned that once in a month my session clerk of those days was absent from evening worship because he was sitting in a cinema down the road while I was pouring out my soul in evangelistic endeavor, and people were talking. I decided I would have to tackle him. Every Sunday morning, when he looked into the vestry friendly-like, I decided to speak, but each Sunday God shut my mouth for months until I felt I would never speak and was tempted to reproach myself for being too cowardly to do so. But of course, one would never dream of tackling anything as delicate as that, fraught as it was with possibly endless trouble, without the full assurance that one was doing it by divine permission, if not command. I had practically given up the attempt and had almost forgotten the intention when one Sunday morning he popped his head round the vestry door as I entered from the other door. And the Lord said, without any voices, "Speak!" I trembled. like poor Nehemiah. And I spoke. He balked and immediately flew into a rage and said he would never change his lifestyle to please me, and stamped out. Next session meeting, he got up, lambasted me in fury, and stalked out, banging the door. And that was the last we saw of him, which was exceedingly hurtful indeed. But you see, I'm quite sure of this. It was God's timing, not mine. And so Nehemiah found his voice, and with all due respect, he explained to the king why his face was so sad and his heart was so sore. The city, he said, the city where his fathers were buried was in ruins, and its gates had been burned with fire. Well, not exactly at the king's request, but you remember the history? After sending Ezra back to reestablish the laws, this very king, Artaxerxes, sent Ezra back to Jerusalem to reestablish the laws when things were going wrong in Jerusalem. The enemies of the Jews, furious at any reestablishment of Jewry in the land, went and demolished their walls and burned their gates. And the Jews were trying to replace them when their enemies sent this complaint to King Artaxerxes that we read of in Ezra chapter 4, verses 7 to 23. And the king replied in these terms, ordering the work to stop. Now these are the terms, Ezra 4 and 18. The letter, he says, you sent us has been read and translated in my presence. I issued an order, and a search was made, and it was found that this city has a long history of revolt against kings, and has been a place of rebellion and sedition. Jerusalem has had powerful kings ruling over the whole of Trans-Euphrates, and taxes, tribute, and duty were paid to them. Now issue an order to these men to stop work, so that this city will not be rebuilt until I so order. Be careful not to neglect this matter, said the king. Why let this threat grow to the detriment of the royal interests? And as soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai the secretary and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. And now this same king, looking into the face of his cupbearer with earnest concern, is saying, what do you want, Nehemiah? And Nehemiah shot up to heaven one of the swiftest and most urgent sky telegrams ever sent up by man. The text says he prayed to God and answered the king. Now, I love that. That's a perfectly balanced statement, and I suggest to you is an excellent model for proper action in things great and small. Pray to God and then speak to man. Don't reverse the order. It'll be too late. Pray to God, and then speak to man. And after all, if this king is under the King of Kings, you can't go wrong by following this order, can you? Of speaking to God before you speak to man on difficult issues. That way of it, you see, the prayer Such prayer is the most practical exercise and motivation in the world. Even if it was to go on for months to obtain an answer, how intensely practical in the end it was. And so you see, this way of doing is the safest, and in the end, the easiest way to work for God in the whole world. You'll see a heading in that Billy Graham news magazine, if you get a hold of it after the service. I think it's in the back page. That says something like this: prayer is the greatest work. Of course it is. Of course it is. There's a sense in which it's the only work, because any work of any use comes out of prayer, because it comes from God. And if God doesn't do it, it better not be done by any man. Because you see, after 4 months of prayer and fasting, Nehemiah's will was so absolutely in line with that of his Lord that the good Lord made it the easiest thing in the world for him to tell the king his full story. If it please the king's majesty and his servant has found favor in his sight, let him, what brave words, let him send me to the city of Judah where my fathers are buried and rebuild it. Those standing around might have thought, what a cheek, what impertinence, how dare he? But when God gave him the power, he dared all right. Well, was there then, following the story, was there then a conversation between the king and his queen? Verse 6. One gets the impression that this was more a semi-private or almost domestic meal than a formal banquet. If there were muttered questions or discussion between the king and the queen, they issued in the question of the king as if he had already decided to grant Nehemiah's request, but simply wanted to know the specification and what Nehemiah sought. How long will your journey be, and when will you be back? I like that. Which in the circumstances, you see, suggests that the king trusted this man as perhaps he dared trust few, a man in his position as a world emperor, daren't trust many. And therefore, he didn't want to be without Nehemiah for long. And is it wrong to suggest that there was perhaps not only a mutual respect between these two men, but an affection which the king may have felt it freer to show than Nehemiah would have dared to the king? However, a time was set, and the whole thing seemed so harmonious, beautiful. Oh, when God does a thing, he does it beautifully, so harmoniously. Like the Lord does when, after much prayer, he begins to act. And I like this word, the smoothness. This is often a sign of the Lord's working. Not always, but often, the smoothness of things. Here takes our breath away. And was so great and evident to Nehemiah that he dared to go on and ask for letters. More letters, Nehemiah? Yes, letters, but very different letters from the letter in Ezra chapter 4, telling the Trans-Euphratians to stop the work. These letters would give Sanballat and Tobiah such a jolt as they hadn't had for a very long time, so that, as Nehemiah says, these enemies of Israel beyond the Euphrates were very disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. Did you see some discussion about lunchtime on television of representatives of Israel and the PLO in America and Egypt? I had just said to my sister, Israel stands by the Bible, but they won't say it in political discussion. When out it came by the representative of Israel, and I was completely contradicted. Ah, he said to the company, we have a history, you know, and it's the Bible. Oh, I loved that. That was great. Nimshi, is it the man's name? Wonderful. Wonderful. Yes, they were disturbed. They were more than disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. And that puts it in a nutshell. Theirs was blind hatred, total opposition to anyone daring to favor the Jews. These pestiferous Jews again, these ubiquitous Jews. Ah, yes, God may punish his own Israel when they sin, and he certainly does, and he's been punishing them for nearly 2,000 years for crucifying their king. Oh, yes, that's why it's all happening. That's why they suffered so, Mr. Hitler. You were a mere tool of the devil. God may punish them when they sin, but the world can't be rid of them. They are here to stay, and no one will push them into the sea and drown them all. Nehemiah also particularly requested a letter to Asaph from the king. And I have this question in the margin of my last Bible. Was Asaph a Jew? He certainly had a Hebrew name, but he was keeper of the king's forest. It looks as if he was another Jew that a king could trust, that a pagan king could trust. Interesting. And I thought of an experience in Jerusalem in 1965. Tom Swanson and I were in a Mohammedan bookshop in Jerusalem, 1965. And the assistant, who was an Armenian Christian, said the owner would never have Arabs in his shop, Jews or Christians, but no Arabs, because he couldn't trust them. We were shocked. But there's another letter to Asaph, you see, and that would provide the timber necessary for the rebuilding. Apparently, Nehemiah had not only been praying for 4 months,
But he had been making practical plans and working out needs and specifications. And it seemed he had it all on his fingertips and was ready to state what he wanted in precise terms to the king. Because, you see, you can do a lot of homework in prayer that turns out to be instantly practical. That is, if your life is a life of prayer, as obviously this man Nehemiah's life was a life of prayer. And he prayed on his knees, and he prayed when he worked, and he prayed almost, I suppose, when he slept. And the overruling and overriding impression of this account, it seems to me, as Nehemiah says, is that of the gracious hand of God controlling the whole thing from beginning to end, to facilitate Nehemiah and all that he had planned. God was with him. But you see, notice this, there's a great contrast in our passage. I want you to notice this. Perhaps you have noticed. There's a great contrast in the passage. May I set it out? It's a contrast between the sweetness and the light of that scene in the king's palace in Shushan and what Nehemiah began to face when he crossed the Rubicon of Euphrates and met those anti-Jewish devils. It is qualitatively the difference, I think, between heaven and hell, for that is the source of the difference. God was in control in the Shushan palace at that time. Oh, he was also in control over the river, but in a different sort of way. That was where satanic opposition to the Almighty, as exemplified in their hatred of the Jews, was manifest. And Nehemiah, like our blessed Lord, had to descend from the heavenly to the satanic earthly to face the dread, discordant music of those who did not know that they were mere pawns in the hands of the enemy in a fruitless task, pitting themselves against the Almighty to try to destroy and eliminate the Jews. Try it again. Try it, anyone you like. Hitler. Anyone. Try it. Try to eliminate the Jews. And so, he moved from a heavenly situation. It was beautiful. I like to think it was a rather intimate sort of parlor dining room place with just a few there, the king and the queen. Heavenly. God was in control, perfectly in control. And then across the river to hell, it would seem. You see, it's because God is so sure of himself that he can afford, are you listening? God is so sure of himself that he can afford to let his enemies rear their ugly heads and oppose him. But you see, the truth is that all God's real enemies are in the bag of his eternal purpose to be carried away into a lost eternity. And in our moments of gloom, you know, when we realize that we have come from the realm of grace and goodness and sweetness and light into the dark caverns of demonic power, like Monday morning after Sunday evening for some of you. Eh? We must never forget that our suffering Lord is the victor. There is never a time when he is not the victor. Even in his cry of dereliction, the why of the cry simply enunciates, I believe. And I've thought of this for many, many years. The cry of our Lord on the cross simply enunciates the incomprehensibility and the impossibility of God forsaking his Son in his evil hour. So Nehemiah simply noted the hostility and moved on to Jerusalem and settled in his new exciting abode. He had come with the goodwill and the help not only of the king of Persia, but the king of kings. The king of kings to do a job. And because of that, no one would stop him in heaven or earth or hell. And of course, that will be increasingly evident as we get into the body of the story. The main thing to note now, I think, is the smooth and the rough. And of course, it is always the smooth of God's holy will which alone enables us to bear the rough. It's the smooth, say it again, I believe it, one has experienced it so deeply, it's the smooth of God's holy will, his smile, his encouragement, which alone enables us to bear the rough. This is why God's work can never be done by mere human effort. And this is why prayer is far more important, as Billy Graham's magazine says. Prayer is far more important than the mountains of organization necessary, as some of it is, for the Billy Graham mission at Pittodrie. Unless God comes down upon that man, it will simply be an exercise of evangelicals showing their flag. And some of the ecumenicals are far keener at processing the streets and perhaps living the life incisively before men. Why don't Christian lives tell? Is your life not telling? On Monday morning, is it because you do not come to an earthly situation with the breath of heaven, with the breath of heaven upon you, as Nehemiah did, crossing the Euphrates and making his way to Jerusalem? Those who have lost or who have never had the heavenly touch in their lives to know the smoothness of the Almighty's working go barging on and barging in, and nothing significant happens except that a good time may be had by all these pleasure-loving Christians. But it is those who have come from the gate of heaven who make impact upon this hostile world and make it stagger and reel and feel the power of the Word of God. how sure-footed Nehemiah was from the moment he heard the dreadful news of the demolition of Jerusalem's walls. He knew what he would do. And it is summed up in the words of the first chapter of Nehemiah. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants. He wasn't relying on his own prayers, but like the Apostle Paul, enlisting the prayers of others, because corporate prayer is necessary, however men may argue against it. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to revere your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of the king. And in terms of the hymn, we might say, and heaven came down Nehemiah's soul to greet, and glory crowned that homely occasion in what I think may have been the private dining room of the king. You notice that Nehemiah used the word today in that prayer ending at 1:11. That means that the prayer of chapter 1 spanned something like 4 months and took him right up to the day when Nehemiah's sadness was noticed by the king. Wonderful. We were to have the Duke of Hamilton's son with us here on Thursday, who is a minister of state for Scotland. He wanted to see where they were spending $1.5 million. But the poor chap missed his plane, and so he's going to come later on. Then the prince wants to come when the job is done. In my own heart, and I'm sure in the heart of Albert Roger and Ramsay Robb, who from the beginning have known with regard to the restoration of this church building, who have known from the beginning that they were engaged in a work of God, building not a wall but a tower, I say, in my heart, I see the clear connection between 46 years of prayer. 46 years continuous prayer and these huge sums of money. They are interested, even the government are interested in our church because it is on Union Street. But you see, it was God who called us to this building on the main street of the city. And I saw the day the Lord said to me, you are for this place whether you like it or not. That's your earthly destiny. And be thankful for it, because it is set in the midst of a great city. I saw then that God had purposes. And who will say what the end of them will be? And God has kept us praying not 4 months, but nearly June the 7th, nearly 46 years. And you see, this about the building is only one of the lesser results of the prayer. Maybe God will grant through Billy Graham, who first came to this building in 1946. God will grant these greater results than the restoration of a building, namely a harvest of souls, as happened, you know, on the night when Billy Graham preached from this pulpit, March 1946. He himself counseled 50 souls standing on a chair through in that session room, one of whom was my cousin Evelyn, who has since served the Lord in different parts of Africa. Isn't this all very exciting? Who would not be excited by it? Not only what God has done, but what he will yet do. The only one who refuses to be excited at such a prospect is he who has no vision, the vision without which the scriptures say.